Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from our earlier years, sometimes single stories, sometimes whole episodes. Keep in mind that years ago, people might have worded things differently than they would today. As always, the title of the whole series, Risk, is itself a content warning. This week, an episode that premiered in June of 2011, it's an episode we call Joy.
Joy. Joy. Joy.
Joy. Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
Joy.
And that's the joy of Risk.
Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and up top, we heard a sound collage by Mr. Jeff Barr, and this behind me now is Icaso by Lesasso. I wish I was kidding. No, I don't wish I was kidding. I was kidding about wishing I was kidding because Icaso by Lesasso makes me giggle. And giggling is a lot of why we're here, my friends, because the subject of today's show is joy. It's summertime and Bin Laden is gone. If I were you, my friend, I'd get those flip-flops on good and snug. Light up a doobie, throw some poppers and lube in the backpack, and hit the town with a little R-I-S-K in the earbuds. Our first story today comes to us from a correspondent from The Daily Show. His new Comedy Central special, Wyatt Cenac, Comedy Person, is getting raves all about the land. Here he is, Wyatt Cenac, with a story we call Runaway.
I also, like Mike, was supposed to do this show a while back, and I bailed out. And I think I was supposed to do the one, Eureka, which that one I actually had stuff for. Like, I was like, oh, I could talk for an hour about the sci-fi television show Eureka. Lots of stuff about that. A town full of scientists, why is it not more interesting? But instead, I agreed to do this, and joy was the topic. And joy is, it's kind of a tough one for me, only because, like, I don't have, like, a lot of moments I can think of as, like, oh, that's a joyous moment. Like, I don't have, like, great moments of joy that I think to, and, like, I've never had those. And I never really grew up with those. Like, my parents aren't, like, Vulcans or anything, but, like, we just weren't, like, celebratory people in that way. Like, it was, I don't know, for some reason, I guess for me, like, I always kind of saw growing up, my thought process was like, oh, well, like, you don't want to be, like, overly celebratory because, like, joy leads to hubris and hubris leads to hate and hate leads to fear and fear leads to the dark side. And I know that I just made a Star Wars reference after I made a Star Trek reference. And fuck you. But I was never that person. Like, I'm a person, like, I love sports, but when I see, like, my team score a touchdown and there's, like, a celebratory dance, I always cringe. Like, I know I'm gonna be that old man at an Eagles game that's just gonna be like, act like you've been there before, but I'll, like, mutter it under my breath because even yelling it is, like, too much of a show. Like, I don't go to weddings because, like, I feel like even that's, like, too much. Like, oh, yeah, it's great that you all found love in each other's arms, and that's wonderful that you found each other. But at the same time, like, half of all weddings end in divorce, and I'm not wishing any bad on you. I just don't know if this is the most appropriate time to do the electric slide. Like, maybe after you've been married for, like, 50 years, then it's appropriate. Now it just seems showboaty. So I say all that because I don't have a lot of moments of joy that I can think to, but I have one from when I was in high school, and I was 17 years old, and I went to an all-boys Catholic high school. And one of the selling points to my parents for this school was that they promised to turn your boy into a man, that they would make a man out of your boy. And so my parents ate it up like catnip and sent me there. And the way they would do this is they would have retreats. They would send you on retreats every year, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year. You would go on a retreat where you and some priests would go out in the woods where, like, nobody could find you, and they'd share secrets with you. Which, it's amazing to think that there was a time when, like, people were okay with letting their children wander off into the forest with priests where no one else could hear. And they were just like, yeah, that seems safe. Get in that rusty van and go with the good father in faith. But that's what we would do. We would have these retreats. So every year you'd go on this retreat and you'd go out into the woods, and it's just like a day-long thing. And we go out there and get to the woods and we watch the Great Santini. And that was the priest's idea of sharing the secrets of manhood to you, was that they took you to the woods and made you watch a movie that we could have just saved on gas money and watched back at school, because we did nothing else but just go out there, eat stew, and watch the Great Santini. And then, like, a priest said a prayer, and that was it. And they did this every year. Freshman year, you saw the Great Santini. Sophomore year, you went back out into the woods and you watched the Great Santini. Junior year, guess what? You're watching the Great Santini again. And that's all it was just somehow watch this movie and, you know, figure out manhood in Robert Duvall having some sort of crazy mixed up feelings about his mortality because his son just beat him in basketball. Like, that's what we were supposed to learn from. So senior year rolled around, and it was like, it's time for senior retreat. And the one thing I knew about the senior retreat was that it was 3 days long. And I was like, shit, I don't want to watch the Great Santini for 3 days straight. That's terrible. And so I wasn't looking forward to it. And then eventually I found out, like, the priests, like, they pulled us aside and they said, since you're seniors, you're men now, and you get to choose what you want to do for your retreat. And so each kid got to individually choose what they wanted to do, and there were three options. And the first option was you would go camping. So a bunch of you would go camping with some priests. And I wasn't really into camping, so I was like, meh, no. And then the second option was, like, you volunteered on a farm. And, like, as a black dude, I feel like doing free labor at a farm just isn't a good look. Like, I don't care if it's volunteer work, it's just not a good look. Like, so I was like, I don't want to do that one. So the next option, the last option, was a silent retreat. And you would spend 3 days in this, like, commune where you would, like, hike, and there was, like, a creek, and there was, like, all this open fields, and the only thing was you couldn't talk. And so I was like, all right, that seems easy enough. So I was like, I'll do that. I'll do the silent retreat. So I went to the silent retreat, and it was actually, like, it was really pretty. Like, you go out, and there's a creek, and you go hiking, and, like, it's really nice. And it's weird when you're somewhere and you don't have to talk, because all of a sudden you have no more obligations. Like, there's, like, this great weight that's been lifted off your shoulders, because, like, nobody's expecting anything of you, and, like, you don't owe anybody anything. So you're just, like, with your own peaceful thoughts. And it was cool. Like, I'd see, like, some of the other guys around. Like, we weren't really supposed to interact, so we'd, like, run into each other every now and again and, like, have some, like, half-assed sign language, like, and, like, shit like that. And So it was cool for the first day. But then the second day rolled around, and it's weird because the reason they gave us this option of the silent retreat was to kind of understand what the Catholic priests go through when they have like vows of silence and stuff. And they call it a vow of silence, but what it really is quitting talking cold turkey. Which, like, when you quit smoking, you at least get, like, nicotine gum or, like, a patch or something like that. But this is just, like, no fucking talking. Like, 17 years of my life, all I've done is talk. And now I can't do it anymore. And I'm starting to have, like, the DTs. And, like, I'm getting irritable and antsy. And I'm just like, ugh. And, like, I brought a book. And I'm just like, ugh, screw you, book. And just, like, and I'm trying to figure out, like, how am I going to get through these next 2 days? And I wound up going to the chapel, and it was, like, this cool little, like, dark room where the only light came from this window that was, like, opaque. And I'm sitting there by myself, and there's a part of me that's hoping for some great awakening. Like, I feel like in high school I always heard about, like, those great Catholic awakenings. And they always kind of promoted that might, you know, send you to the priesthood. And I hadn't totally ruled out, like, becoming a Catholic priest. I wasn't Catholic, but I'd seen the priests at my high school, and it was like, I saw them, and I thought, like, they actually have, like, a pretty decent life. Like, they live rent-free, and they get, like, 3 square meals a day. And I thought about it, and I was like, yeah, I could do that. Like, I left the church part out of it, and I was like, I could totally do that, like, live at this school and then just spend all my time in the gym working on my basketball game. And then, like, I'd join the NBA. That was, like, the thought in my head, was that I'd become a Catholic priest and then join the NBA. And then just, like, I figured, like, that would be it. Like, I'd fucking be, like, the pontiff in the paint. And, like, and nothing happened. I sat in this chapel, and there was no awakening. And the opposite thing happened, where I realized how I would get through these next 2 days, which was by sleeping through them. And that's what I decided to do. I decided for the next 2 days, all I was going to do was sleep. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, I would eat food, and then I would go back to sleep. And if I woke up from a nap, I would go back to sleep. Like, I never left the bed. If I was asleep, if I was awake in my dreams, I'd force myself to go asleep in my dreams. Like, it was just, I'm not waking up for 2 days straight. And when it was time to go, we're, like, all outside waiting for the bus. And I'm well rested. Like, that's the most rested I've ever been in my life. And it showed, because I was, like, jittery with, like, energy. And I'm noticing that, like, other guys are also, like, kind of jittery. And I'm like, looking at them, and I'm like, and they're like, and I'm realizing, like, we all fucking bailed on this, and we all went to sleep for 2 days. And we're all just, like, there's all this energy, and we're like broncos at, like, a rodeo stall, just like, and one of the priests is finally like, look, the bus is running late, so if you guys want, you can start talking now. And I think he was hoping that we would have, like, integrity for his fucking struggle and be like, and instead, we just started screaming. Like, not even words, just, and running and screaming and just, like, just hugging each other because we finally could speak again. And it was, like, so much joy, and, like, this euphoria just washed over all of us, because here's this thing you take for granted, the ability to speak, and it's taken from you, and now all of a sudden you can do it again. And I just had, like, all this energy and excitement, and I got back home, and my little brother and I were both home that afternoon. Our folks weren't home yet, and so my little brother and I were there, and my little brother went to the kitchen and, like, made himself a bowl of cereal, and so he's eating cereal in the kitchen, and I'm still trying to, like, come down from this high and get this energy out of my system, and I'm like, I'm looking at TV, and I'm, like, flipping channels, and I wound up stopping on Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And the reason I stopped was because I saw a guy run and do a backflip off a brick wall. And I was looking at it, and in this moment of just like everything that's going in my head, like time is slowing down and I can see things and hear things more clearly. And I look and I understand the mechanics of what he did. That like, oh yeah, he jumps off his right foot and then uses his left foot to both plant and give himself momentum that he uses to sort of go into the backflip, and it just does itself. That seems really easy. That's easy. I could do that. I should do that. Let's do that. And full of joy, I come running down the hallway and into the living room, which was right next to the kitchen where my brother's eating cereal. And I jump off my right foot, and my left foot hits the wall and stays there. And all the joy leaves my body, very much like all the milk is leaving my little brother's body as he's spitting cereal all over the kitchen table in shock. And there's a hole in the wall. Because what I didn't account for was that he did this on a brick wall, and I did this on drywall. And now I'm totally sobered up, and I'm just like, shit, fuck, this, like, there's a hole in the living room wall. And, like, my folks, my mother and my stepfather are coming home soon. I don't know how to explain this. Because if I told them that, like, me as a 17-year-old sort of man decided to try to do a backflip off their living room wall, like, they're gonna have me committed. There's no way I can do that. I can't explain it that way. So I'm like, I have to think of something more plausible. And my little brother and I came up with the idea that, okay, here's a more plausible explanation. I was chasing my little brother through the house, and he slipped, and his shoulder fell into the wall, because it was about a shoulder-sized hole. And to make sure, we jammed his shoulder in it, sort of worked it in there so that it fit. And then also so that way he had like some drywall crumbs on him so it looked real. And we figured this would be a good way to sort of just spread the blame around between like me, my brother, and the guy who built our house. Like, this is also on you, contractor. And so my parents come home and they're not thrilled. They're not thrilled at all about it. I'm surprised. But they're not very happy. And they didn't, like, we couldn't fix it. Like, it was one of those things where it's like my parents weren't like, okay, let's throw money at this problem. You know, we couldn't pay to fix it. So there's just a hole sitting there reminding me of this moment of joy that I had. And it just sat there. And then a little bit after that, I had a birthday, like a few weeks later. And when I was a little kid, my mother had made this banner. And it was like a 20 by 30 banner. And it said like, happy birthday, Wyatt. And there was like a cake on it. And when I was a little kid, she would hang that up in the living room. So I'd walk out and I'd be like, oh yeah, there's that banner for my birthday. And so now, turning 18, she hangs up this thing that I used to only see as a child on the wall to hide the hole. And it works, and it's up there, you know, it's like my birthday happens, and it's up there for like a week, and then 2 weeks, and then a month, and then 3 months, and it stays up for almost a year until my brother's birthday, where we replace it with his banner. And there's something very weird about having a birthday banner up for like 9 months out of the year in the room that your parents entertain people. Because your parents' friends generally don't give a shit about you. Like, they know enough information about you to, like, sort of get that part of the conversation out of the way with your parents. Like, oh, how's Wyatt? He's good. Okay, I don't care. Let's talk about what we really want to talk about, wine. And so it was always very weird to be in my house when, like, some of my parents' friends were over, and they would see this banner, and they'd be like, oh, it's your birthday. Happy birthday. And it's like, no, it's not my birthday. That particular moment of joy that you just felt is actually, it's just a mask for what is a lot of damage underneath. And really, I don't know if this is the most appropriate time to tell me happy birthday or to start doing the electric slide. So for me, that's joy. Like, joy is this great moment of happiness followed by a giant hole in drywall. Thank you.
This is Risk. We heard a little something from Jeff Barr called Happy Thoughts, and this is called Bath Time in Clerkenwell by the Clerkenwell Kid. I'm going to try something new now, something a little different. At the Risk live shows, I often tell these short stories between the big ones. So now we will transition from me to me. We call this one The Still Heart. Well, it's no surprise that on the subject of joy, a lot of people think of relationships. I was reminded that I did not have a boyfriend until I was 31. And I wanted one since I was 3. I was conscious of wanting one since about 3. I spent my 20s just worrying and worrying and worrying about this. And I would go through hell just to bring myself to say hello to a guy, like at a bar. And if I got to the awkward point that I actually got his phone number, then I would spend the next, 48 hours going, is he going to call me? Am I going to call him? How long do I wait? How long is, what's he thinking now? So if it was going to work out at all, it was going to have to be that he would like to be with a basket case, basically. So nothing shook. And then it was in 97, I was at this gay pride parade with all my friends. We're watching the circus come down Fifth Avenue. And just to our right, there's this super cute Filipino boy. Actually, he's just to our right, but he's actually like 20 feet above us because he has climbed a telephone pole. And I look over at him and he smiles at me, this big, beautiful smile. And I didn't have time to think. I just smiled right back. And then I got shy and looked down. But every time I looked back up, we were smiling at each other. And I'm like, there's no more perfect time to say hello, except for one thing. He's 20 feet above us on a telephone pole. What am I going to be like, hi? And in retrospect, I could have just walked up and said, hey,
come on down, which a police officer was surely about to do at any moment. But then my friends were like, no, we gotta get to this party. The ecstasy's about to kick in. Let's get the fuck out of here. So my friends start running off and I'm like, oh no, I'm gonna lose them. So I start running after them. And now the Filipino boy and I are looking back at each other and it's like, okay. And then 4 years later, I'm walking down Park Avenue. Now this was in October of 2001. So for the past month, the city had just been going through every emotion imaginable because of 9/11. And there was something about that period, just the vibe of New Yorkers in general during that period, where it was like people were a little less neurotic, people were a little less bullshitty, people were just like a little more real. So I guess I was just kind of in that state. And I'm walking down Park Avenue and I'm crossing the street and I see this big smile pass me. And then we turn and we're both smiling at each other. And again, you know, I can't help it. It's just a big smile. And we start to say hello to each other. And he says to me, you know, we've smiled at each other before. 4 years ago at the Gay Pride Parade, I was up on top of a telephone pole. And I said, holy fucking shit, I totally remember that. And there was just this instant like connection between us. And we had a little chat and we exchanged phone numbers, but it was walking away that I had this kind of surreal experience. I realized I'm not worried. I'm not asking myself, am I gonna call him? Is he gonna call me? When? None of that. I just felt this kind of like calm. This like peace with the fact that, yeah, we're gonna be getting together. And so that, I think, was one of the most profound moments of joy for me. The lack of the worry. And that was, in fact, the beginning of my first relationship.
Now that was a song about one of the simple joys, doing the laundry. That is by the Small Dinosaurs, a.k.a. Cerebral Pauly, from an album called Household Songs. Look up the Small Dinosaurs on MySpace. This is Ultra Cat behind me now. Here's a story by the very funny stand-up comedian, Mr. Mike Lawrence. It's called Confessions of a Bleeding Penis.
So, you know you have a really depressed friend when they constantly tell you this is the happiest I've ever been in my life. That is a sure sign, and I say that about 6 or 7 times a year. So I've said it like at least 4 times this year, but no, I'm really happy. But I remember the first time I ever said that, and that was in high school, and I truly did feel like I was the happiest that I'd ever been because I finally found something that I was good at, and that was slam poetry. Now, I remember spending many years like trying to just do something. We all try to find our identities. I remember I wanted to be an astronaut, and then it was a combination of realizing how much math was involved and the movie Apollo 13 coming out that made me not want to do that. I wanted to be a wrestler, and then I realized it was fake, and then it didn't seem exciting to me anymore. I wanted to be a superhero, and I realized that was fake. And so I didn't have any purpose. I was really depressed, and I remember being invited to this. There was a poetry club at the local library, and I went, and I did my first poem ever, which was called Love, on my 15th birthday, which for the next few years I called my rebirthday, because that was the day I found myself. And so, fun fact, atheists can be more annoying than Christians. I was so proud because, and then I would go every single month, and I was so committed to it. And I feel like the amount of joy you have in a particular moment can be personified and valued based on how much shame you have when you look back at it. So that truly was the happiest moment of my life because it was so sad. And I would go to this teen poetry meeting every single month. My dad would take me, sit out in the library lobby for about an hour to an hour and 30 minutes, which I didn't feel bad about because he used to take me to AA meetings when I was 6 and I'd be in a church lobby. So I felt like I was getting even on some level, except the alcoholics eventually changed themselves. The poets are still what they are. It's the only difference. Because like most people would go and they'd have 1 or 2 poems. I would read 7 or 8, but have 10 to 15, and I would just write and write and write, and I had so much to say and so much to feel and think, and I believed that everyone wanted to listen, and I was in the high school literary club. I won a poetry competition in high school. I won the Cinquain Award, Best Cinquain, and this was literally my Cinquain. It's a 5-line poem. I die, but no tears fall, no sympathy at all, just another death in this world, that's all. I spent 8 hours on that. I was so proud of it. I still have the plaque. What if that was the guy in second place, just giving you credit where credit is due? But yeah, it was this amazing thing. I remember at the Poetry Awards, there was a band that dedicated their cover of the Cranberry Zombie to the victims of Columbine because they hadn't suffered enough. One of the saddest moments of all this, by that I mean happiest back then, was I wrote my own screenplay. Anyone write their own screenplay when they were 16? No, just this dreamer? Yeah, I wrote my own screenplay, and the name of it was Definitive Verse, and it was about... it was very fictional. It was about a teenage poet named Johnny Angel who killed himself so that the world may live. We started shooting it. We have like 5 minutes of footage, which the world will never see. So I'm glad I get my own the day the clown cried. Feels good. But I remember I went to the make your own t-shirt place at the mall and made my own Definitive Verse t-shirt. On the front it said, "A poem a day keeps the therapist away." And on the back it said, "Definitive Verse 2000. Now, there is nothing more sad than someone going to the make your own t-shirt place with a purpose. That is not a good thing to do. But I was so committed to this. I remember when Columbine happened, they checked my bags. I was banned from my prom for two reasons. One, I wrote a poem about how certain people at the school should die. And I had the face of someone who looked like they would do that. So I had to sign a waiver that would say I would not go to my prom. And I didn't. Now, the thing about poetry, I spent 8 years doing this stuff. And I went through some of my old poems over the last few days, and they don't make any sense to me. They had titles like Call Waiting, W-A-D-I-N-G. There's no meaning. It's just really clever. There was another one called Confessions of a Bleeding Penis. Oh, I want to preface, no sex, drugs, or rock and roll during all of this time. Just so you know, nothing was touching this during any of these poems. And the moment... I think the moment that I realized that, I remember like my first MySpace profile under the description, poet, dreamer, explorer, in that order of importance. I was so committed to this. I went to open mics all the time. When I was 18 years old, they threw me out of the teenage poetry club at the library. For two reasons. One, I was too old, and two, I made too many of the other girls cry when I told them their poems were crap, and that mine were the only ones that mattered. And I was really committed to it. And then what ended up happening was my dad was like, I know you really want to do this. There was only one other poetry club in the city, and it was at a local Barnes & Noble, and it was all Jewish senior citizens. So I went from one extreme to another. I went from, I lost my innocence but gained common sense, to, I don't know the difference between a bagel and a bialy. Only a dollar, by golly. These 85-year-old people who have experienced everything in life were writing about pastries. That's what they wrote about. And people who had gone through nothing in life were writing about all the pain and suffering that they had had in the world. But I'd say the defining moment that made me realize that this is something that I couldn't do anymore was, it had eluded me for years, but I had finally gone to my first official poetry slam. It was the West Palm Beach team. They have like different teams and they do national competitions and stuff. What happens is you go up and you do your poem, and then they pull out numbers, like, you know, 0 through 10, and they grade you. And I got in 7th place. Now, that was okay. What wasn't okay was everything that was in places 1 through 6. That made me realize this is something I could never do. There was a poem called Asian by Persuasion, where a guy was like, my skin may be yellow, but my mood is mellow. I am for real in this shit. 2nd place, that guy. He beat me by 5 fucking places. I realized I couldn't compete in this based on the competition. There was, oh man, so much rape poetry, so much. From the rapist perspective even, like creepy old guys going up. Have you ever touched a dream? Do you feel it in your hands, like silly putty, like a flag waving in the wind? This stuff, I remember their poetry more than mine, because hate lasts forever. And the only way that I could describe this moment of going to this poetry slam was, do you guys remember that Blind Melon video, No Rain? When the little bumblebee girl gets made fun of and she goes to the field of all the other bumblebees and she's dancing. That's exactly what it was like if I realized how much I fucking hate bees. Ugh! bees suck. Like that's I couldn't do it, and I pretty much I stopped doing poetry, and I went to an open mic the next month and did stand-up comedy for the first time at an open mic called the Chocolate Moose that I'd been doing poetry at for 6 years. It was basically like if Dylan had gone electric, other than it, that it was at a coffee shop and nobody knew who Bob Dylan was. That's exactly what it was like. And I've been doing that ever since. And I'm a lot less proud of the work that I do, but I'm a lot happier. So that's got to count for something.
Street in a rain, boom, boom, baby. Ready to let it go. Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa up. Listen to it, pat. Light it up and take a puff. Pass it to me now. I'm going down, down, baby. Yo, street in a rain, boom, boom, baby. Ready to let it go. Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa up. Listen to it, pat. Light it up and take a puff. Pass it to me now. You can find me in St. Louis rolling on dubs. Smoking on dubs. The club blowing up like bubble buzz. Sipping buzz. Getting perfect.
That was one of the groundbreaking mashups by the freelance Hellraiser that's Nelly and the theme from the British television series of the 1970s, Grange Hill. The mashup is called City Grammar, and this behind me now is the Do or DIY clan, as well as People Like Us, with a song called Awful Fun. Here comes one of my favorite people, just a wonderful guy, and a truly great storyteller, Mr. Adam Wade, with a story we call Night in Hoboken.
My name is Adam Wade. I am originally from New Hampshire. First 23 years of my life I spent in New Hampshire. I went to college, Keene State College in Keene, New Hampshire, and I always wanted, my dream, when I was like second grade, I got Crooked in Times Square, the book, I wanted to move to New York. And finally, when I graduated, I moved to New York, and I'm not gonna lie, like I had a few hookups in college, but nothing to write home about. So when I moved to New York, I was expecting that a lot of things were gonna go well with the ladies and me. But I didn't live in like Manhattan or one of the boroughs, outer boroughs. I lived in Fairview, New Jersey. That's where I got housing because I didn't know anybody. And it's about 45 minutes away from the city, and I would take the bus into work and stuff. But it was very difficult socially because I lived alone. And in Fairview, there weren't a lot of women my age, and there weren't actually any bars. So I would go to bars, and if I ended up doing well, my options were to spend $100 that I didn't have to take a cab all the way to Fairview, or go to the Port Authority, and they had like the little gypsy buses outside, and take the bus back with the girl. And it never worked out. But after 2 years, I moved to Hoboken, New Jersey, and potential. And when I said, just a lot of bars in Hoboken, and I had my own place, and I just figured it was just going to be a hell of a lot easier. So I scouted like the bars, and I found like this Irish pub that kind of fit my personality, and I started going there on the weekends, and I would get there like around 6:30, I get a beer, and then Miller Lite, you know, I'd kind of nurse it for a half hour, and then at 7 I'd get my burger medium well, and I would just sit there, and then I'd finish that, I'd get another beer, and then when I was done my burger, it was like around 8 o'clock, I would stand by like the jukebox and just stand there till like around 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I would go home. So I was at the time I was a production assistant at NBC Sports, and I used to tell everybody my problems and stuff, and I had like a couple mentors that were like older guys that worked there, like the sound guys, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm going there, I'm finally in Hoboken, I have my own place, you know, I'm ready to go, and they're like, well, you know, you smiling or you never smile? I don't know. They go, well, smile. See what I go? I smile. They go, well, smile. I'll smile. So. Same thing, I would do the same thing, and then when I was at the jukebox, I would just smile, and like, I'm probably like too much, because like, they started calling me like, hey, look, it's Guy Smiley, and they're like, it's the smile guy, and it was frustrating. So I was like, guys, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm doing everything you say, like, I'm going, I'm smiling, and they go, all right, well, let's break it down. Now, when you go, like, what time do you go? I go, you know, 6:30. And then they go, Jesus Christ. They go, no. They go, what time do you leave? I go, like, 10:30. I mean, I got to get up. I got to go to sleep. They go, no. Take a nap or do what you got to do. But then you go at, like, 11 o'clock and stay till closing and see what happens. As the numbers go, things will get better. You smile. You get your beers, and we'll see what happens. And I go, all right, I can take a nap. They go, drink Diet Coke, whatever you need to do. Just get there, stay, and then just sit there and smile and see what happens. So I did, and after about like 8 weeks, it happened. And it was like dwindling down, and I was sitting there, and then I was like, all right, I'm going to go. And then I'm like, all right, stay 5 more minutes. And this girl, she was like a very, very thin girl, came over to me. She was pretty, and I had I'm a lightweight, 4 beers, so the beer goggles. So I go, hello, and she goes, hi. And this was like my first real conversation with the girl in Hoboken. And I go, how you doing? And like, I was getting what I wanted here. This is great. I was very nervous. So I sound like, and she's like, you want to do something? And I go, yes, I do. Well, you know, there's a 24-hour bagel place. You want to go get a bagel? And she's like, no, I don't want to get a bagel. I go, oh, all right. Yeah. She's like, why don't you take me home? I go, yeah. And now she's like, yeah, I go, okay. So like, we're walking home, and the whole thing is like, I made her like, she was doing me a big favor, and she did talk like that, like she was. So, but I was lonely, and I was just very happy. Like, this was great, and so we go down to my basement apartment, and she's not impressed. And I'm very neat, so it was, but it was clean. And she goes, no way. I go, what? And she goes, I will not hook up with a man with a twin bed. And I'm like, come on. And she's like, no. And she's ready to leave. And I go, I got a bigger bed. I got full size. And she's like, where? So I went under the bed, and I pulled out, like, when my brother comes, I pulled out the air mattress. And like, for $7 more, you could have got the one that plugged in and you hit the button. But I didn't spy. I have just like the little pump that you have to do manually. And like, I could say, yeah, I was trying to be quirky. And go, no, I was just desperate, and so I was just pumping it up quickly. And she's like, well, have a good night. Nice meeting you. I go, wait, hey. Did you know, like, Sylvester Stallone lived on one of these when he wrote Rocky? And she's like, what the fuck is that supposed to mean? Well, what it means is, you know, it's like, I got potential. And then, like, she grabbed the door. I go, wait, no. One more. Hey, let's face reality here. It's 2:30 on a Saturday night. This is the best you can do. Which is good. I was working on my confidence. Which is good. So you can go home now and, you know, feel bad for yourself. You can come over here. Come over here and you can hug me. She didn't hug me yet. She left. So I went to work the next day. I go, what the fuck you guys doing? You're telling me to smile. They start making fun of me. You're telling me to do all these things. I go, they go, no, you're doing, this is awesome. I go, how is it awesome? They go, it's so awesome. You're doing it. It's going to happen. You're playing the numbers. It's going to happen. But this is huge. You're making huge steps here. I go, huge. They go, just keep doing what you're doing and it's going to work. I go, all right. And then they were good guys. Like, okay, okay. So 11 weeks later, it was a big night for me. So the bar's closed, there's like four girls left. A healthy sized girl of the group came over to me. And she was like a plus size Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's. Like, and that's my go-to of the Go-Go's. Belinda Carlisle has always been my favorite. So we start talking, and it's very easy. And I've had four beers again, so I'm pretty much shit-faced. So I go, oh, hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? And she's like, oh. I go, yeah. And she goes, you know who I like? And I go, oh, who? And she's like, Marvin Gaye. And I'm like, he's got a great voice, doesn't he? And she's like, yeah. I go, yeah. She's like, do you have any Marvin Gaye at home? And I go, I got his greatest hits. I got his greatest hits, you know? And I go, you want? And she's like, well, why don't we go to your place to listen to him? I go, that would be wonderful. We'll go now, right? And she goes, yes. So we walk to the door, and I go, wait, I just, full disclosure, and I like to cock-block myself in good situations. So I'm like, I just want to let you know, I live in a basement apartment. Yeah. She's like, I don't care. And I go, oh, great, great, great. And one more thing, I got a twin bed, you know. She's like, I don't care, take me home. And I was like, oh, great, you're a nice girl, you're a nice girl. So we go home, and we get into the apartment, and like, I'd like to say it was like the best porno ever, like what we did and stuff, but it was extremely awkward. There's a lot of like dry humping, and I was trying to get my pants off, and there's a premature ejaculation, and I was just trying to get back into business, and I couldn't, and we were hugging a lot, and like going around, but she didn't complain, she was just happy, and it was great, like, and I was happy too, but like, not like, everything, it was perfect, so we just kind of tuckered out after, and like, we fell asleep in the bed, and like, about 2 hours later, like, I woke up, and to this sound, and it was like, no disrespect to her, but it was like, whew, whew. And I go, Jesus Christ, because I hadn't been in a bed with a woman or anybody else in a long time. So I was like, oh, and I look over, and I'm like, kind of like pinned to the wall because the bed to make space. And I look, and it's her, and she has like a cold, so she's like snoring. That's her way of snoring. And she's got like snots on it all over like her face. And she looks beautiful, you know. She looks like an angel, you know. And I'm just like just watching her sleep for a little while, but I really gotta pee. And so then I just kind of like go around her, and I get off the bed and I pee. And when I get back to the my bedroom / whole apartment, I look, and now she's like spread eagle on the bed, and then she's taking up the but like she has like, she's sleeping, but she has like a smile on her face, and I'm not like an egomaniac, but like in my mind I'm looking at her, and she looks very satisfied. I mean, she looks like I've so a night with Adam, and she's been satisfied, and so there's no way like I'm gonna wake her up, so I walk over and I look over at her, and I get down and I pull the air mattress out. I start pumping it up, and like I get on the air mattress and I'm laying there. And the way she is, the way she's like on the bed, like she's got her arm over, and it's like hanging. And I put her hand in my hand, and like that's how like we fell asleep. I've been in Hoboken for 8 years, and I don't want the shtick. I've been with women, a few, and no disrespect to them, but like without a doubt, that was like the best night I've had in Hoboken. Thank you.
That does it, folks. If you're going to the beach or you're going to the park, don't forget to put a couple episodes of Risk on your iPod and tell your friends to do the same. This is Skybox behind me from their fantastic album, Morning After Cuts. They're at skyboxmusic.com. Today is the day, folks. Take a risk. This is my best friend, and this is my birthday cake.